Is that right?
You got it exactly right.
All right. Thank you. Okay. We're ready when you are.
May it please the court. Amy Ruland on behalf of the appellant, Next Point Real Estate Partners, which I'll refer to as HCRE. In this case, the bankruptcy court refused to allow HCRE to withdraw a single proof of claim with prejudice, forced HCRE to continue to pursue that claim through trial, and then sanctioned HCRE for doing so. That was error, and the court's sanction award should be reversed. Today, I want to talk about two main points. First, there is no evidence in this record, much less the type of clear and convincing evidence that's required, that HCRE, the party actually sanctioned in the case, acted with the type of bad faith that is required for the bankruptcy court to invoke its inherent power to sanction. And second, there is no evidence that tethers any action taken by HCRE to the attorney's fees actually incurred by Highland in this case, making the sanction award reversible as well. On the issue of bad faith, the federal courts, including the Supreme Court of the United States, have repeatedly made clear that a finding of bad faith requires a court to explore the offending party's motivations for acting and has to find some bad intent. And this court in McGuire Oil versus City of Houston held expressly that negligence is not bad faith for purposes of this analysis. Instead, there has to be some sort of intentional deception involved. Similarly, typically a finding of bad faith requires more than finding a party pursued what became a meritless cause of action. There has to be something else, a something more that involves nefarious intent. So, for example, the party filed the claim for harassment purposes. The party pursued litigation for all the wrong reasons or for deception or for deceptive purposes. The party engaged in rampant discovery abuse. The party repeatedly violated court orders. None of that evidence exists in this case. And in
fact, what about admitting that you had no basis for the claim the whole time?
Well, Your Honor, in this case, I don't think that's a basis for finding bad faith. And again, HCRE.
What about withdrawing the claim 2 days before the seminal depositions and having really no basis to have done so?
Well, Your Honor, the case law explains that withdrawing a claim for tactical advantage, and that's not what happened here, but just putting that aside, withdrawing a claim for tactical advantage isn't a reason to refuse the withdrawal of the claim.
Even though you also admitted that there was no basis for the claim all along.
HCRE, the party that was actually sanctioned here, testified, its managing member, Matt McGraner, who was also the executive vice president of the company in charge of the day-to-day affairs of the company, testified specifically that he reviewed the entire gamut of financials of HCRE prior to this proof of claim being filed. He looked at the agreements at issue. He talked to in-house counsel. In-house counsel communicated with outside counsel who prepared this proof of claim form, and everyone in that chain of command was satisfied that the proof of claim was viable prior to its filing. So the fact that one person, that's Mr. Dondero in this case, testified that he didn't review the proof of claim and didn't personally investigate it isn't a basis for finding bad faith. By the way—
Well, he's not a bit player.
He's not a bit
what
player.
What about resisting the disqualification of this law firm, which was patently obvious?
Well, disqualification of this law firm isn't a basis for the fees in this case. So the disqualification fight has no causal connection to the fees actually awarded in the sanction award. So it really doesn't matter what happened in that disqualification fight.
Well, I don't know how it does it. Isn't it evidence of bad faith? You know somebody should be disqualified, but you oppose the disqualification.
In this case, Wick Phillips, which is a sophisticated law firm, hired professional ethics counsel, reviewed the case with its in-house counsel, and determined that there wasn't a good basis for its disqualification, and that's why they fought the disqualification motion. And I don't think we can tag HCRE with its counsel's investigation and its counsel's decision to continue that fight.
When does all this add up to a pattern, though?
Well, Your Honor,
And how long is the court supposed to tolerate it?
Well, that's a great question. The problem here that we have is that there isn't, and I still don't understand to this day, whether what happened in this case was for bad motivation, for ill intent, was for, you know, harassment. There isn't any evidence of that extra something that would allow the court to infer from this record evidence of bad faith. And in fact, I think what the court engaged in was the type of post hoc reasoning that the court in Christianberg counsels against by looking backward and saying, oh, you know what, I'm going to figure out how to piece together a pattern of behavior to sanction this particular party. And that's improper.
Well, I don't know how you can make a determination without looking back. You have to look at the history to justify the determination to do the sanction.
Well, let me.
You're not suggesting you're going to look forward to do that, are you?
No, Your Honor, but like it matters when you look back. Okay, so in this case, the major offending pieces of conduct were, number one, the fact that Mr. Dondero testified he didn't personally review or investigate this claim prior to its filing. Put aside that HCRE, the party sanctioned, did do an investigation, but let's say Mr. Dondero's testimony in October of 2022 was that, you know, hey, he didn't do the right things. Why not look back at that point? Why didn't Highland seek a sanction against Mr. Dondero as soon as it had that testimony, or a sanction against HCRE when it had that testimony? Why wait another 9 months and let this case go on without seeking some sort of relief from the court for the continued pursuit of this claim? That's not what Highland did.
Well, if it's bad acting, why is there a time clock on when the court can deal with it? I mean, you're making an argument as if the court was just ignore an admission. I mean, bad conduct. You're saying it doesn't matter?
Again,
I mean, you're making an argument that because something else didn't happen to somebody else, it therefore vitiates the court's action against a party who's kind of made some admissions, court's found bad faith, et cetera.
Again, Your Honor, I'm not saying that the court should ignore bad conduct. What I am saying is that the conduct at issue here, the conduct that the court actually points to, isn't a basis for a bad faith finding and total fee-shifting sanctions.
What's your best case?
Sorry?
What's your best case that says that?
I think McGuire Oil is a very good case, Your Honor, because it holds that negligence, let's say Mr. Dondero's actions were negligent, right? He should have reviewed the proof of claim.
But did the court ever utter the words negligent?
No.
Okay.
But I don't think that the conduct...
You said McGuire says negligence shouldn't equal. Gotcha. But I mean, what words here connote the court finding, quote, negligence as opposed to bad acting, you know, bad motive?
The court's finding that Mr. Dondero's failure to investigate the proof of claim is bad faith isn't supported by any case we found. I mean, and I've looked. You would think that this kind of thing would come up a lot more frequently. But the only case that we found that was analogous is this Henry Cushman case that we cite, where exactly the same scenario played out, right? There was an authorized representative who signed the proof of claim form. That representative didn't read the claim form, didn't know if the debt was owed, didn't know anything about the claim, but relied on the company itself, i.e. the party that was making the claim, to perform that investigation. And the court in Henry Cushman said, that's not sanctionable bad faith. And absent some other case law showing that this one...
Well, every case is different. I mean, you don't have to have precedent for everything. If you got bad acting way back when, law school 101, bankruptcy was kind of a court of equity. You know, and there was this old notion about you don't come into bankruptcy with unclean hands, so to speak. I mean, I'm admittedly a brontosaurus, but I'm just saying, you know, there at least was that notion. Maybe it's dissipated in the world of AI, but the point being, the bankruptcy court was deemed to be that the court is looking at the players. I mean, equity, doing right by the party. So these notions of mendacity, et cetera, are part of the crucible. And I stepped on Judge Wilson's question. I'm going to come, but I might forget mine. He'll remember his. But what I'm saying is that, but I'm just saying, I asked you what was your best case, because you're just trying to say the court found negligence. And what my question was, what's the best case you have? If you say that case said negligence, but where we're talking about bad faith, and that seems to be here. And the two cases you cited don't seem to me to be there, but I get your argument, but that's all I'm saying. If the court, where's the temporal requirement? Because you seem to say, because the court didn't make the determination at some point in the continuum, it vitiates the ability to make that determination. So what I'm asking is, where's the case that imposes some temporal requirement? If you see it, you've got to do it here versus somewhere else.
And I'm not necessarily saying, Your Honor, that there is a temporal requirement. I'm saying that if this action was by Mr. Donzera at the beginning of the case was so bad, there was a lot of time for Highland to do something about what it considered to be bad conduct.
What does Highland have to do with the offending party's conduct? I mean, that's where you're losing me. In terms of, you're trying to say because of what Highland did or didn't do, somehow obfuscates what this person did overhead, step one. If the first witness in the case lied and 100 witnesses testified in the trial, the fact that the lie occurred in the first witness is not obviated by the fact that it wasn't the 99th witness. You see what I'm just saying? In the dynamic, why are you spending so much capital on when the district court or the bankruptcy could, if it was so bad, why didn't you do it here? If you didn't do it here, then you must have found that it was negligent, and that's the reason for why it occurs otherwise, and there's no case law to support that.
Okay, I want to address this very directly.
Right.
I think Your Honor and I disagree on what constitutes bad faith in this context.
Okay.
And my position in this case is that Mr. Dondero's mere act of not personally investigating the proof of claim did not lead to the litany of attorney's fees incurred by Highland in this case. There were lots of other things that occurred along the way. And if Highland bore any form of responsibility for those things, then the fees can't be charged to HCRE. And this court in Williams versus Lockheed Martin said that bad faith requires something more than sloppy acting, right? It requires an exploration of like the intent behind the filing of the proof of claim. This is something I don't understand to this day. What is the bad intent here?
Right.
What was Mr. Dondero or HCRE trying to accomplish that was contrary to their ethical obligations to the court or to their opposing party?
My question was going to be, this is a fact-finding, isn't it, by the bankruptcy court?
It is.
Ultimately?
It is, but the bankruptcy court didn't engage in the right fact-finding.
All right, but you've got, you're talking about Dondero's failure to investigate the claim, but McGraner said, McGraner could point to nothing, no evidence whatsoever that the way this LLC agreement was, the ownership interest were allayed, was mutual mistake. The whole basis of the claim. And so, in other words, he could point to nothing either, correct?
He couldn't in terms of what the agreement said. But
all right, but the other thing is somewhere along the line, he said, yeah, well, Dondero's mistake was not changing the ownership interest before the bankruptcy. And then basically people came in and he couldn't just do it himself. That was his mistake. And didn't he say something along those lines also?
He did. But again,
in other words, can't the bankruptcy court add 1 + 1 + 1 and equal 3 equals bad faith?
No, I don't.
I don't know how that's clearly erroneous.
And again, we come back to this like case law that says
I'm not talking about the case law. I'm talking about the factual account of this case. And it strikes me that yes, okay, it may be negligence on Dondero's part, but you have utterly zero, nothing, negative, nada to support the proof of claim. At the end of discovery, God knows how much discovery was spent on this, depositions, et cetera, and so forth. And what you have is also procedural artifice. We're going to withdraw the claim 2 days before the depositions are to start, et cetera, and so forth. We're going to oppose disqualification of counsel that is patently conflicted in the case. That's what you have, but I don't see anything on the other side of your ledger.
Well,
how does that not add up to bad faith, or at least a non-clearly erroneous finding of bad faith?
Well, clearly erroneous isn't the standard to be applied here. This court has to look at whether there is, on a de novo review, whether there's clear and convincing evidence to find that there was bad faith in the acting that led to the shifting of fees. And here, there isn't that bad faith finding. And again, I want to emphasize
here, there's not clear and convincing evidence.
There's not clear and convincing evidence. In fact, I would posit there's no evidence. of bad faith motivation here, which is required. And I'll reserve the rest of my time for rebuttal.
I just gave you 2 minutes. I occupied about 2 minutes.
Okay, great. Thank you, because I would like to answer this question.
I occupied about 2 minutes of your time, so clerks just gave you 2 minutes.
Okay, great. And so back to your question, we have to keep in mind here that there was sophisticated counsel involved. First, there was Bonds Ellis, then there was Wick Phillips, then there was Hogue Gamaris. All along the way, HCRE was advised by counsel, and its basis for the proof of claim was some kind of equitable reformation of the underlying LLC agreement. Equitable claims are inherently amorphous, and the bankruptcy court is a court of equity. So if there was really no basis in the world for pursuing this proof of claim, why didn't sophisticated counsel along the way advise HCRE, hey, you gotta stop this, this is a terrible idea? Why didn't anyone seek to hold counsel for HCRE liable for violating Rule 9011? That just didn't happen, because this isn't the type, fighting a losing claim, fighting a losing battle is just not the type of bad faith that courts look to in deciding to assign fee-shifting sanctions. And so that's the difference here, and the court's resulting fee order was error.
You're not arguing that we have to have precedent on point with this conduct in order to affirm the district court and the bankruptcy's determination of bad faith on this record. You're not making that argument.
I'm not, Your Honor, but
You're
I am.
You're just saying this record doesn't support.
I'm just saying this record absolutely doesn't support the finding.
Okay. All right. Well, you've reserved your rebuttal time.
Thank you, Your Honor. Right.
Thank you.
All right, Mr. Morris.
Good morning, Your Honors. John Morris, Pachulski, Stang, Zeal, and Jones for Highland Capital Management. I'm Judge Stewart. I was the trial counsel. I've been the trial counsel for Highland since the day it filed for bankruptcy. I've done every single one of these cases. This is a really simple case from my perspective. Respectfully, I think Judge Wilson got it exactly right. From beginning to end, this is nothing but bad faith. Mr. McGrainer and Mr. Dondero testified unambiguously that they had absolutely no facts to support the claim that there was a mutual mistake or that there was a failure of consideration. And without a mutual mistake or failure of consideration, you cannot reform, rescind, or modify the agreement. There was absolutely no basis for this litigation. The bankruptcy court determined that Highland had actually established by clear and convincing evidence that HCRE acted in bad faith and abused the judicial process by filing and prosecuting this proof of claim. As a sanction, the bankruptcy court directed HCRE to reimburse Highland for its costs and expenses incurred during the litigation, exclusive of the costs arising from the disqualification motion. We did not seek that. That was not part of the award. After conducting a de novo review, Judge Scholer in the district court found that the bankruptcy court's determinations that HCRE had actually had filed and prosecuted the claim in bad faith and abused the judicial process were, in fact, supported by clear and convincing evidence, and the district court affirmed. We urge this court to do the same. I want to try to be brief here, Your Honors. The bankruptcy court did not rely on any one piece of evidence. To its considerable credit, Judge Jernigan issued a remarkably detailed decision with chock full of citations to the factual record and the history of the litigation. And you do have to look backwards. You do have to look at the totality of the circumstances. And again, from beginning to end, there was nothing but bad faith here. We begin with the filing of the proof of claim. Mr. Dondero was not negligent. He was irresponsible, and he falsely declared that he had a factual basis for signing the proof of claim. That's number one. And he knew, as he testified at trial, that he knew of no basis to assert mutual mistake. He knew of no basis to claw back any portion of Highland's interest in SE Multifamily. After Highland objected to the proof of claim, you know what? I want to pause here for a second because I think it's so important. Counsel suggests that somehow Highland should have brought bad faith the moment that the proof of claim was filed. We could not have done that because we had no knowledge. Mr. McGrainer and Mr. Dondero controlled both Highland and HCRE at the time this transaction was entered into. And Mr. Seary, the court-appointed fiduciary for the estate, had no personal knowledge. We're the ones who needed discovery. So we could not at that moment say, aha, the proof of claim is fraudulent. We had to take discovery, and that didn't happen until a long time later. But I digress. Point number two, after Highland objected to the proof of claim, HCRE filed a response. That response was unambiguous. It said specifically that based on their review of the amended LLC agreement, there was a mutual mistake or a failure of consideration entitling HCRE to reformation, rescission, or modification. That statement was false because, as Mr. McGraner and Mr. Dondero ultimately admit, there was no basis for those factual assertions. That's point number two that the bankruptcy court focused on. Point number three, Wick Phillips.
How many points are you going to make?
Five.
All right, well, then let me go ahead and ask my question. Because the upshot of the appellant's argument seems to be that everything that happened was on advice of counsel all along the way. And so they were just doing what the lawyers told them they should be doing by proceeding with the litigation. What do you say to that?
A number of things, Your Honor. Number one, this is the first I'm really hearing it. I'm sure that they had lawyers. This is their fourth set of lawyers on this one piece of litigation alone. I have no idea.
What?
This is their fourth lawyer. They started with Bonds Ellis, then they had Wick Phillips, then they had trial counsel, now we've got appellate counsel, right? I have no idea what they told their lawyers. I have no idea what their lawyers told them. We haven't had a waiver of the attorney-client privilege. What I will say, and I can use this as a piece of evidence, is at the hearing, Mr. McGraner finally admitted what they didn't disclose earlier, and that he knew and understood at all times that Wick Phillips had represented Highland and HCRE in a joint representation in connection with the negotiation and drafting of the original LLC agreement, the KeyBank loan agreement, and the amended LLC agreement. So I would hope that they didn't share that with Wick Phillips at the time of the disqualification motion, because I can't imagine a firm of Wick Phillips' quality pursuing and defending the disqualification motion if they had known what Mr. McGraner ultimately admitted to at trial. So I think that's a complete red herring, and I think it ignores completely the testimony, the unambiguous, indisputable testimony. This isn't about negligence. This isn't about losing a case. This is about prosecuting and pursuing a proof of claim that you know to be false, that you know there is no factual basis. And it's not just their testimony. We had BH Equity's testimony validate the fact that there was no mutual mistake. We had Mr. Dondero's tax returns that he authorized to be filed on behalf of SE Multifamily that established the exact same allocation of interests between and among BH Equities, Highland, and HCRE. We had the contemporaneous documents. We had the emails back and forth between BH Equities and Mr. McGraner and his team saying, is the allocation correct? Yes, the allocation's correct. The evidence is, it's not just that they failed to prove their case, it's that they knew at all times that they had no case. So, The Wick Phillips point is number three, because ultimately we went through this frolic and detour. We had to hire experts. We had a hearing. We did some discovery. My mistake was not deposing Mr. McGraner. And so Mr. McGraner sat silently by as we went through this pathetic exercise. Point number four was the last second motion to try to withdraw their claim. They don't have a right to withdraw their claim. They can withdraw their claim only if they meet the Manchester factors or they otherwise persuade the court that there's a good faith basis for doing so.
Okay, let me ask you, take you there. On the, since you mentioned that, at the point that they made the offer to withdraw their claim, I mean, going to the fees that the court awarded, if they made an offer to withdraw the claim, notwithstanding everything else, that sort of cut off under our case law the causal relationship, shall I say, for purposes of impose. Said differently, in other words, all kind of, once they said, Your Honor, we want to withdraw the claim, and the district court disallowed that, but there's a fact that they offered to withdraw the claim, mitigate the ability of the judge legally to impose fees that go after that point in time. You follow what I'm saying? The
trouble I do.
In our In Re Highland case in 2024, seemed to say after it was a lot of discovery, et cetera, but if there was a factor that was irrelevant to the court's determination, there was no power by the court to impose a fee. And so when you were headed in, you said they had no right to withdraw. So just factor that into if they didn't, that would seem to maybe answer my question, but that part gave me pause. If the party seeks to withdraw it and you say, no, I'm not going to let you withdraw it in order that it perpetuates my ability to sanction you for something. You see what I'm saying?
I do. It's a very, very fair question. And my response, I think, is pretty straightforward and simple. We went forward because HCRE refused to agree that not only its proof of claim was valid, but that it would never challenge Highland's ownership of its interest in HC in SE multifamily based on the concepts of rescission, reformation, and ratification. So you can see it in their motion. You can see it in their reply brief. You can see it in Mr. Dondero's ambiguous statements on the record during the hearing. And you can see it most conclusively in HCRE's closing argument at the trial on the merits. They tried very hard to distinguish between the proof of claim and their claims for rescission, reformation, and modification. And what they continued to say time and time again is, go ahead, disallow the proof of claim. But what you can't do, Judge Jernigan, is you can't do anything with our claims for reformation, modification, or rescission, because those are legal claims that had to be pursued in an adversary proceeding. Their refusal to give Highland what it was entitled to, because again, you have the proof of claim and then you have the Wick Phillips response. Paragraph 5, it's in the record at 806. You can find exactly what the proof of claim was, right? This is their statement that they had these factual predicates of mutual mistake and failure of consideration that gave them claims for reformation, rescission, and modification. They wouldn't give the latter up, and that's why we went forward. And it's really important to understand, and I'm sure you have read the record, at the end of that hearing, Judge Jernigan specifically said, you have not met your Manchester burden. Nevertheless, I am going to give you time to try to resolve this. So concerned was Judge Jernigan that she made sure the U.S. Attorney's Office would be involved in any stipulated resolution of this, but she specifically gave HCRE an opportunity to give an order that fully addressed the court's and Highland's concerns, and there's no evidence in the record that they did that because they didn't do so. So we went forward, and these costs were incurred because they tried at all times to retain their claims for reformation, rescission, and modification. And then the fifth point is the hearing itself. It was remarkable, and it was really only that at that time that the thought occurred to me that this has been a complete and utter waste of time. And it was a complete and utter waste of time because we had the bald admissions from Mr. Dondero that he did no diligence, never read the document. If he had just read the one paragraph proof of claim based on his testimony, he would have told somebody, no, we don't have a right to all or some of Highland's interest in SE multifamily. We don't. That allocation is exactly what we intended because that's what he testified to, right? He and Mr. McGrainer unambiguously admit at the end of the day, the document says exactly what we thought it should say. And so I just want to close, Your Honors, by saying this case is really important, and it's not just important to Highland. I think it's important to the entire bankruptcy arena because we have somebody here who didn't just file a proof of claim that failed to succeed. That happens. We have sometimes in bankruptcy cases creditors who file proofs of claim by the bar date, because if you don't file by the bar date, then you have another hurdle to jump over in getting a late claim recognized. So you have some people who file a placeholder at the bar date. But when you're called out and the debtor objects to that proof of claim, it's put up or shut up time. and they put up a bunch of nonsense. It's very much like, I don't know if Your Honor will recall, but we were here a while ago on what we referred to as the notes litigation, where...
Was that in July?
Yeah, it was, I don't exactly, yeah, it might have been. But I'll remember this because it was so powerful to me. Your first comment to my adversary was, isn't your client's position preposterous? And you were exactly right.
Subtle question.
It was. I appreciated it then, and I appreciate it now. And I think this is preposterous here. You can't raise your right hand and swear that there's no basis for a mutual mistake, there's no basis for a failure of consideration, and pursue this claim. You just can't. And I urge the court to not only sustain the lower court's determinations, but to send a clear message to the people who practice regularly in the bankruptcy bar, that if you're going to swear that you have knowledge of something, you better have some knowledge of it. You can be wrong. We're all wrong. Nobody should be sanctioned for being negligent, but that's just not what happened here. Unless the court has any questions, I have nothing further.
All right. Thank you, counsel. All right. Back to you, Ms. Rule.
Thank you, Your Honor. I want to address a few things that Mr. Morris said. First of all, the proof of claim that Mr. Dondero signed didn't contain any of these legal arguments about rescission, reformation, or anything else. It really just said, hey, we think there might be a basis for this claim and we need discovery to determine whether to go forward. That's number one. Number two, totality of the circumstances isn't the standard. And the court in Goodyear Tire versus Hager made this clear. The court there said, listen, only in the most severe cases with the most egregious bad faith can a court say, oh, based on the totality of the circumstances, I'm going to shift the entire cost of the case to one party. Instead, what the court has to do in most cases of bad faith is look at each particular piece of bad faith and tether that bad faith to an actual fee incurred by the opposing party.
If the court's determination were made based on circumstantial evidence, which we all know circumstantial evidence is good as gold, but if somebody admits on the stand under oath a set of facts that are not true, how, pray tell, does that fit with your argument? There's no circumstantial evidence the court is making determined based on direct testimony, evidence in the record, that there's no basis for it. I mean, how does that not connote to bad faith, or said differently, how do we reverse a fact-bound, Judge Wilson, start off asking, isn't this all fact-bound? You got two judges, bankruptcy judge, very experienced, et cetera. You got a district judge, you got two judges who looked at this and bound in these fact records, made a determination of bad faith based on his testimony and everything else. Now, what do, articulate the holding for me of why that's reversible error, factual.
Your Honor, this is a case where in discovery, on the merits of the case, by the way.
That wasn't my question.
I
said articulate for me in a declarative sentence what this panel's holding would be, finding reversible error on a bad faith finding. That's what my question, not what was in discovery.
In this case, there is no clear and convincing evidence that HCRE, the party that was actually sanctioned, acted with the type of nefarious intent, wrongfully pursued a proof of claim, notwithstanding that it was represented by counsel and counsel was advising it. There is no evidence in this record that is clear and convincing that HCRE, the party sanctioned, acted with the type of bad faith motivation that would be required for this court to sanction it for the entirety of the attorney's fees incurred.
I admire you for keeping a straight face as you look me in the eye, but it's tough. You're smiling now. I mean, you were working hard to keep a straight face when you see this.
Your Honor, let me address one other issue that I think is really important, which is what happened after and during this withdrawal hearing. Mr. Morris just got up here and said, as they did in their briefing, that that HCRE didn't meet the Manchester factors, that HCRE didn't agree to withdraw its claims with prejudice, that HCRE made clear throughout these proceedings that it wanted to pursue its claims of reformation and rescission on another occasion on another day. First of all, I think the record is very clear that HCRE at that withdrawal hearing not only agreed to withdraw its claims with prejudice, agreed that it wouldn't challenge the interest of Highland in the underlying entity, SE Multifamily, agreed to waive any appeal of the issues before the court. And again, these issues of reformation, rescission, these legal theories, it is still to this day unclear to me how HCRE would have pursued those claims at a later time. The claims date, bar date, had already long since passed. A with prejudice withdrawal has a res judicata effect.
One last question. What's your best case that it was reversible error for the court to disallow withdrawal of the claim?
I mean, I think you can look at Manchester itself or Inri Lowenschuss. Both of those cases say, listen, under the circumstances presented here, the bankruptcy court should have allowed withdrawal of the claim. And by the way, if the bankruptcy court was at all concerned about HCRE doing something bad in the future or seeking to relitigate this stuff in the future, Rule 3006 allowed the bankruptcy court to put any conditions on withdrawal that it saw fit.
I got your argument about should, but my question was about must, and I'm going to take your answer that you don't have a question that requires reversal of the fine here. I get your argument that the court should have done something different, but that doesn't sound responsive, that, you know, there's a case that we just can't ignore. In other words, that would mandate us reversing on that basis. But that said, we've got your argument. You're able counsel, and we appreciate the briefing. These are the kind of cases we set oral arguments so we can, there's a lot going on in this case, and we appreciate both of your responses to the court's question as well as the briefing.
Thank you, Your Honor.
The case will be submitted. Thank you.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Mr. Morris, as well.